projects, which is a great way to sort of tie all of this together. And then after Mary's presentation, we'll take questions from the floor on any of our presentations that we've had so far.
Thank you, Johanna. So I just want to acknowledge these are individuals from my organization, the Cancer Prevention Institute of California at Stanford University, University of California, San Francisco, and Santa Clara County Valley Health and Hospital Systems, who've been quite involved in the whole process. So I have nothing to disclose. So for today, what I'm going to be focusing on is pretty, give you some background on the methods of how we evaluated this process, and share some initial impressions, as well as a little bit background of the participants. So to give you some background, the Live Healthy, Live Long project really is focused on reducing disparities in colorectal cancer among the Vietnamese Americans through two types of core activities. The lay health worker intervention research, which is really modeled from previous research that focused on cervical and breast and hepatitis B in the Vietnamese community, specifically in the Santa Clara County, San Francisco Bay Area. They're still in the process of gathering data, so I can't really go into much. And then the second component, which I'll be sharing today, is about the evaluation of that, how the community participants, the partnerships, are interacting together. So the key two key groups in this project are the project partners. The Vietnamese Reach for Health Coalition has been around in existence for over 10 years. It actually was initiated through Reach. And like any coalitions and collaborations, they are now moving to self-sustaining. So despite not being part of Reach USA, they're moving towards that, and they've been around 10 years. The second group of leaders are the Community Advisory Board of UCSF Vietnamese Community Health Project, Soka Levang. So my apologies to anyone who speaks Vietnamese if I didn't pronounce that correctly. And then, of course, the core community-based organizations, the Asian Americans for Community Involvement, Catholic Charities, Immigrant Resettlement and Cultural Center, and Vietnamese Voluntary Foundation, who've been critical in really serving the community. So these were the two core questions that we wanted to address through the evaluation. What are the qualities of partnership between research and community? I think we know that anecdotally and so quite visceral, but it's important to really see that and hear that from the different partnerships. And then how does community-based participatory research project creates equitable research, community partnerships, and community benefits? And you know, many of the participants who are on the panel, they have primers, they have a lot of language there, and always that struggle about how do we make it more equitable? Will we ever make it equal? I think a lot of research needs to be done on that. So some of the eligibility and settings, so as I mentioned before, it's the lay health worker providers, the community leaders, and the researchers. These were the individuals who were interviewed. In regards to the lay health worker providers, we focused on both the administrators and actually the coordinators who worked with the lay health workers. And then, as mentioned, it's primarily based in San Francisco Bay Area. So we used a interview topic guide. There are about 21 questions and 5 primary categories. The first focused on really wanting to hear the partners understand what is the context and the history of their participation in this lay health worker project. So really looking at not only their role, but how did that decision came to them and their organization to want to participate in the project. Also, what benefits they expect from it, not only just whether it's being a subcontract and better served organization, but were there any organizational structure as well as strategic decisions. Then the third is what sometimes we always focus on is partnership dynamics, really finding out how extent did the various partners were involved in the research design, the implementation, and the dissemination results. But also, what throughout the process, what kind of opportunities did they have to really provide constructive feedback or were welcome to provide feedback? And most importantly, that perception, where their feedback, was it more just a process to check off, or did they feel that they really were integrated into the study? The fourth category was really assessing the partnership effectiveness and benefits. So there's when the interviews were going on, some already completed the lay health worker project and some were still in the progress. So it's very interesting to see their perception, and this is, I believe, a 3 or 4 year project, so sometimes retention is quite short. So really, the overall satisfaction of the project, if they did see any organizational changes, and did they see that being participating in the Lay Health Worker Project actually influenced whether negatively or positively with their work with the community that they were serving. And then the impact for potential partnerships in the community. So finding out more, not about the work that was being done, but how do the Vietnamese American community really perceive health research and researchers, you know, amongst all their priorities of dealing with making sure they have food for their children or dealing with joblessness and so forth. And finally, lay health worker model, really understanding that concept and how did that influence the understanding of research and the value. What we also asked as a follow-up too is we wanted to know the participants, how would they perceive the other participants who are being interviewed? Where would they be coming from? How would they would respond to these questions to kind of look at their judgment and assumptions? So in regards to the interview, the overall process from, you know, informed consent to the follow-up took 2 hours, and it was done at various sites to the convenience of the participants. So it ranged from the work site to even a coffee shop. So, and we used digital recorders. But the interview themselves lasted about 60 to 75 minutes. And here's the activities and time frame. So to kind of reference, our hope was to actually finish the coding and be able to provide more substantial analysis at this conference. But as you can see, we're still in the coding process. But we are able to provide some preliminary information. But our ultimate goal is to ensure that we can share these findings to the community that are serving it. And usually our community health forums to the Vietnamese are done bilingual. So that will be in 2012. So moving into the data analysis, I'm just curious, how many of you are familiar with grounded theory, just by show of hands? So I will say that I'm still learning about this theory. I'm very excited about being part of this project, so kind of get my development in this area. But what I learned and valued about it is that it provides that structure and the parameters, but it doesn't impose strict rules, and I think that's what's beautiful about qualitative research. And for those in the room who are not too familiar with the theorists, Glaser and Strauss, they were sociologists in the 1960s that collaborated and wanted to learn more about the dying process in the various hospital settings to really kind of solicit how do the health professionals as well as the patient perceive the dying process. So, and these are the three core areas of the framework. Okay. But then in 2006, Kathy Sharmes was able to take this very deep philosophical framework and how to really, as practitioners, which I really I consider myself, to apply that in the real world. And so where we are is, you know, the transcription process and really taking all, transcribing it verbatim, including the ums and the ahs and the pauses and the laughter, and then reviewing that and then focusing on coding, just, you know, the initial coding and the focus coding, really like separating and sorting and synthesizing the data. And then when you're looking at where, once we're done with this area, the memo writing, so really looking at the themes. So some of this, especially those who are in qualitative, we already do this instinctively, but to really have a lexicon, a framework to follow this theory is very helpful. And then finally, theory development, and that's something where my principal investigator is very excited to be part of. So as I mentioned, we're still in the coding phase, but I just wanted to share a little bit more, some background on the participants. We only had a sample size of 13, but we did aim for 10, and primarily they've been delay health workers, service providers, which is critical, and then followed by the community leaders and the researchers. And the demographic data we collected was all self-reported, very open-ended, even though it was a survey. We made sure that there wasn't too many categories because we wanted them to self-identify. Thank you. And then this will actually give a good preview to sort of the impressions that I learned. So for the most part, they were bilingual, bicultural. There were a handful in Vietnamese. There were a handful who were representing non-Vietnamese communities. So going into impressions and moving to the last one, Having not done work too closely doing research with the Vietnamese American community, other than serving them as a provider and as a practitioner, as a community health educator, it was very interesting. Even these individuals who had extensive, even advanced degrees, that there was a prevalence of humility among the Vietnamese American respondents. And for example, when they self-reported about their language capability, they found themselves rating themselves fair, where in reality, I think many of you would probably consider them well or more. And so some initial impressions, and it sort of leans to the issue of power. They have different perspective, the lay health worker project, you know, in regards to the stakeholder versus the job role, understanding what their priorities are, what freedom of access that they had to the information. And as I mentioned, the power dynamics of, you know, wanting to make sure are responsible and responsive to the researchers and ensure for future partnerships. Oops, I'm going backwards. So in moving forward, since we're still in the process of coding, but these are some key themes that are kind of rising to the top that we would love to explore and hope to tease it out once we finalize the coding. What are the stakeholders' understanding of the Live Healthy and Live Long project? Not just about what the outcomes, but the roles. And then the power, what are the levels of control and influence within the project and the partnerships by the stakeholders? The decision, to what extent do the stakeholders have the ability to impact decision process made pertaining to the lay health worker project, and what are the stakeholders' perception of their accountability to the project? So to close, just want to acknowledge three key people or groups. Simili Sawunmi, who was entering the demographic data and doing all the transcribing. Loan Dao, who originated this study and did a lot of the formative work. And of course, always the interview participants for sharing their wisdom and volunteering their time. And then I would like to close with this quote. So what happens to you does not matter. What you become through those experiences, all that is significant. This is the true meaning of life. It's a Zen meditation on understanding. So thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And please join me in thanking all of our presenters. I think this was a really excellent session. I know people are anxious to, you know, be moving on to the next session, but if you do have questions that you want to ask or some discussion, I invite you to stick with us. We do have some time until the official end of this session, and if our presenters don't mind sticking around for a few minutes. Do we have any questions? Okay, we've got a couple. Let's see, and you're seated directly in front behind each other. You can work out who goes first and who goes second. Yes.
I'm interested to know what folks who presented the photo gave in terms of guidelines to participants about privacy, confidentiality, and protections.
Okay, and I think you'll have to come to the mic. The question was about what the guidelines for photo voice participants were regarding privacy and informed consent and confidentiality.
Well, the recommendations by Wang is that they have to, the participants, of course, sign an informed consent to participate in the study. So, of course, they are protected with the qualitative getting their name removed. And when they're taking photographs, we try to instruct them to not take pictures of people. Dr. Wang will even say, unless it's necessary to tell the story. So if you have a person that you're taking a picture of, they're supposed to provide them a release form, like you would sign a release, like if someone was taking your picture to put in the newspaper, to let them know that that picture may be published in some type of literature or in a presentation, etc. So they have to get permission from the individual first. If it's a child, of course, you have to get permission from the parent. In order to actually have their photographs, because essentially they own their photographs because they're taking them. So we as researchers have to then have them sign a release form that we can actually use the pictures in which they identified as the ones that they wanted to illustrate to tell their story. So there's kind of that three level of consent that has to be done. So.
And we had another question right in front of that previous questioner.
Peer-reviewed publication, and then there's the media, and they serve different purposes, and reach different audiences.
here because they have such a long title that it, when cutting it down to 15 minutes, we let that go. But this was funded by the National, the original research study was funded by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NCDC, and they were not interested in policy or even testing and intervention. They wanted us to collect the data and do it through an echo. They loved the idea of the ecological, and we didn't even get to talk about the different levels on which we collect the data. What we learned early on was that we hadn't written in nearly enough money for translation, partly because, as you know, if you're doing CBPR, every time you change a question, you have to send it back to the IRB in English and Chinese in this case. So, you know, we just needed, plus to do our job in terms of education and giving back to community and sharing all the way along and simultaneous translation, not nearly enough. So we also wanted our community partners to get more out of this than they would through a straight research grant. Their reason for joining us was that they wanted to have people trained who could then work with them, be part of their campaigning. As you saw, their title was Chinese Progressive Association. Acted on the progressive, they really want trained organizers. And so to make it worthwhile for them, we wanted to bring in a grant to them, you know, with our name not anywhere on it, that would just help them achieve their goals as well as our achieving ours. That was a separate project. That was the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project. My strong belief, and I've argued this with deans and other people, is if you are not willing to let the research findings go out, particularly the early findings, you know, once they're, you're confident that they're accurate, but if you're not willing to let them go out before waiting the year and a half or 2 years for peer review, you shouldn't be doing CBPR. There are plenty of journals that now publish CBPR and are fine with, and in fact like the idea that you've already shared findings with the research, with the community, and that you're already working on policy. That's part of what they want to hear about. So I would, you know, there are a few journals that say we will not accept anything, but I don't think most of us are going to JAMA, and that's fine.
Not to slam JAMA.
No.
I'd be happy to get our papers in JAMA.
Yeah.
Right. Wouldn't that be a great accomplishment when we can have a community-based participatory research session that JAMA is just waiting to pick up? So, another question in the back?
Their sort of weight loss and gym activity. And it's a free training session. We have that's why Dr. Wang recommended that brainstorming session, because so that way it already gives participants an idea of what they kind of need to focus their efforts on.
When you're done, at the very end, I just want to say something, an apology. to the translators.
I think we can take one last quick question, and then if you've got additional questions for folks, maybe they can hang around.
My question is about the use of the blog, and I also want to thank you for sort of like helping us understand what unifying health is in America. And do you think that you're going to be using the blog as intervention tool for the deaf community?
It could possibly be used. We do have a project that we're going to be fielding soon called Deaf Waywise. And a lot of the translation of the program materials has been done in American Sign Language. We're adapting a program that originated in North Carolina among rural women youth there for a healthy lifestyle intervention. And we're certainly going to be applying the same blog concept to explaining a lot of the teaching material that we're going to be using in the Deaf Waywise project.
Is it going to be evaluated?
Definitely. Well, of course, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to evaluate and measure things. I don't know if some of my colleagues can help me with this, but we are giving them, you know, not just a few questions, but we're asking questions, we're doing biometric measurements of all of our participants as they join the project. It's a healthy lifestyle and weight loss intervention.
Okay.
I say my apology. I'm sorry. I just want to apologize to the people who are hearing impaired and the people who are translating for them, because I know in trying to get our speech the right length, we went as fast as we could talk, and I think I won't do that again if I can help it. But this was a wake-up call for me. Thank you.
Well, let's thank our speakers one more time, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. We look forward to seeing you in other sessions.